said, we're gonna give the boys a hand.
Welcome back to the official Leeds United podcast and part two of our Dave Hancock interview. Some great stories coming up. Enjoy.
That wasn't exactly an easy move to Chelsea, was it? Because of a certain man.
We know Mr. Betts very, very well, so I'm sure Leeds fans will be,
Matt, you love
will
him,
be
don't
eager
you?
To hear.
Matt is one of your favourite chairmans ever, isn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I treated Ken when I was at the club. And then Dennis and Gus came in. I knew Chelsea were sniffing and my contract was due to expire, I think, in June or July. And I think it was January. And I think it was just 2006 or 2007. Basically, they had the situation where two of the young lads had got poached from the academy and they had to go to a compensation tribunal. Chelsea ended up paying a couple of million, I think, for the kids because they'd been illegally approached, right? So there was a lot of, and obviously from the years past, a lot of animosity between Leeds and Chelsea, okay? So I was like, you know, I want to do right by Leeds because Leeds had been done right by me and I had such an incredible time there and was able to do lots of different things. I was like, I want to be able to walk back into Leeds at any point in time in the future. I don't want to just say, screw you, I'm out the door and I'm jumping ship to Chelsea because they're, you know, paying me more money. So I sort of said to Chelsea, and Peter Kenyon was the chairman, was the general manager or the secretary at the time. I said, look, you need to deal with my contract situation with Chelsea. You tell me, or they can tell me when they're going to release me. And I said, but I need to do this right. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait for me to finish my contract at Leeds when I'm basically a free agent to move on. And they said, yeah, you know, we admire that. And I said, I'm not doing it any other way. So Dennis kept coming to me. He says, oh, you're going to Chelsea? And I said, well, I don't know what the situation is. That's up to you. So one day I got called to the chairman's office. And he said, sit down, son. He said, so you're going to go to my old club, are you? And I said, well, Mr. Chairman, if you allow me to. He says, yeah. He said, me, son. He said, I've been in this game for 40 years. And he says, I've never had a transfer fee for a physio. And I looked at him because I didn't know what had gone on. I said to him, I said, what do you mean, Mr. Chairman? He said, they just paid me £250,000 to get you released from the club. Now, remember, I only had 3 or 4 months left on my contract, right? So I said, really? He went, yeah. He said to me, more Russian money coming in my pocket, right?
Sure, that was terrible for him.
I cheekily said to him, I said, Mr. Chairman, do I get any percentage of that transfer fee?
you didn't, did you?
I did, yeah, I did. He said to me, he says, you want to go? I said, yes, Mr. Chairman. He said, well, shut the f*** up then and sign on this contract. And afterwards, I shook his hand and he gave me a wink and he went, good luck, you're joining a good club.
Blummin' heck, I never knew that story, man.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
To be fair, he got a very good point. Like, that must have been the first ever transfer of a physio.
Well, I didn't see any of it, but anyway. But I wanted to do right. I'm being really honest. I wanted to make sure that I could, you know, at some point in time, do things like this, right? That I didn't leave under a cloud. And that, as I said to you, I had some really incredible memories and experiences and worked with some incredible people at Leeds United. And it will ever be within my heart. And I keep watching the scores and the games whenever I can here in the States. The other story that I was going to throw to you, it was Christmas parties, Bridgie.
Do you know what it is? I was just going to say, before we go on to the next chapter, it takes us over to America. The Christmas parties we had at Leeds United, the one that stood out for me, before you go any further, I'm going to say it was when we all dressed as soldiers.
Matt, I'm going to paint this picture for you. Okay. So,
please do.
So obviously, you know, social media, cameras, all these things weren't really around then, right? You know, there was the traditional Christmas party. And there'd been lots of situations. Like, I remember one time when I was at Wolves in the 90s, where Brian Law was a Welsh centre half. They nicked a bus. They nicked a double decker bus, right? And this is in the public eye. And he drove the double decker bus around. And apparently there's a guy on the top deck. This is 6 o'clock in the morning. And he crashed the bus. He crashed the bus on the ring road at Wolves, right? And the next day he came in because he was injured. He came in for treatment. And he, like I said, just come in the afternoon, right? And I remember, and he said, I've done something terrible. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, what have you done? You know, he's like, no, really bad. And then he said to me, I've crashed a double-decker bus, and I just didn't know what, I started pissing myself laughing. So I'd been used to these, throughout the whole of the 90s, I'd been used to these Christmas right. party stories, okay?
Yeah.
So it was a very traditional thing to do. They always had a theme. So the boys decided that they would do military. So the idea was that they would come in the morning, they would train, and then they would right. get dressed, and then they would go out in the afternoon, and it would go all the way through, and then the following day would be a day off.
Right.
Gary Kelly came in like a full camouflage with a mask and a, like the whole nine yards, right? So they've all come into the training ground, left all the cars at the training ground, trained, and then basically got changed and then gone in a bus and left the cars at the training ground. So Seth had a buddy who was
Seth
just-
Seth Johnson.
He had a friend who was just like...
His nickname was the Lummox.
Odd job.
This kid was a lunatic.
Where's Seth from?
Seth
Derby.
Is from...
Is he from Derby?
Derby, yes. Yeah. I've just recently been with him and caught him on a golf course, and he's still as mad and still as lovable as ever. Like, but this kid took it to a new level he basically lived with Seth. It was like the Gaza had Jimmy Five bellies. Seth had the Lummox, who called Lee.
And he's in full costume as
oh,
well.
Yeah.
He's
oh.
in his fatigues.
He used to drive the car and this, that, and the other, right? And he had this toy, okay. Toy rifle gun. The first team had gone training, and then I don't know what they use now, but they had the old, scaffolding towers so that the guy would film the training.
Okay.
So we had one on either edge of the pitch. Okay. So the first team are training, and I've come out to cover training, and I've stood there with my bag and I'm watching training. And obviously I've seen all the players come in the military gear. Some of them come in the treatment room. We're all having a laugh and blah, blah, blah. So I've gone out to cover training, and I've stood and watched, and I'm watching training. All of a sudden it caught my eye. I see this guy on the tower. And he's in full military gear, right? And he's basically parading and like snipering with his gun, right? And then like as if he's like covering the land, right? And standing to attention at the top of this camera stand while the first team are going through full training. And the best bit was Eddie and David O'Leary didn't see him. So I'm stood there watching this guy, right, for about 10 minutes until Eddie goes, get down,
it
right?
was David O'Leary said, who the bleeding hell's that up there? And this guy just looked down and he actually saluted David O'Leary.
He saluted him!
And then he came in to say, get down, it's a bloody health and safety risk. And it was the Lummox. And as he got down, he apologised and he said, I've just made £100 off the players for doing that.
Oh, my God.
It sounds like we never played football, doesn't it? It sounds like Carry On Football, this. It sounds like we were just, you know, we were Ragged Ass Rovers. But we when it came to playing, they were very professional, honestly.
No, but it's stuff like that, isn't it, that you say that created that camaraderie that not a lot of teams probably had. Probably even less so nowadays.
Yeah.
With all that kind of being sanitised out, you know.
We were very lucky in the time frame we had, I think. I mean, obviously Dave's still involved in sport, and I know Liam Cooper and the lads down at Leeds. It's just as tough for them away from the game now because of the social media and how much you're in the media eye. I don't know how much banter goes on in the dressing rooms and things nowadays that we encounter.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about social media. I'd be worried about SO19 coming down and picking him off.
The sad thing is that O'Leary and Eddie Gray didn't see him.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. But I can imagine Eddie with smoke coming out of his ears when he saw
Eddie's
him.
Eddie's angry. Right, Eddie never swore. I never heard Eddie Gray swear. That shows how much of a mentor this guy was. You know, when he came through with Paul Hart and he saw the lads going, and then David O'Leary, a master stroke, getting Eddie Gray alongside him as his assistant to develop and mentor the lads.
Master stroke.
Never heard him swear ever. You knew when Eddie was angry when you heard the word "cheesy peeps." Right, that was his swear word. And if you heard him say "cheesy peeps," you knew he was angry. So when he saw the Lummox on top of that tower and he went, "cheesy peeps," we're going, oh, shit, it's going to hit the fan here. So, oh, but that was Eddie's go-to word. Like, so that just shows him. We had it unbelievable. Not only did we have great staff members in Dave and that, But to know that there was somebody there like Eddie that was a Leeds legend that wouldn't let you get away with an inch. He would push you to the limits. He's Eddie Gray's tens runs. I just think we were blessed to have somebody like that, because he knew if you did step out of line, it was his football club. Forget David O'Leary. It's not David's football club. David was there as the manager. Yes, he's the gaffer. It was Eddie's football club. And that's why we you know, stood to attention, no pun intended, because Eddie, if you did step out of line, he knew you were upsetting his club. So we always pushed the boundaries and had banter, but we never, ever took the pee, because obviously you can't do that in the DNA, what Eddie instilled in us.
And, you know, I talk about, like, people. So, like, we talk about Lucas just as a human being. Eddie Gray's another one. Just like as a human, forget about how great he was as a footballer, but as a man, I mean, you know, I'm still talk to him and whenever I come back, you know, I try and see if I can go and have a drink with him. He was fantastic for me. Like, would give me some great insights, give me some ideas. You remember, I'm young, so I realized that I couldn't be the player's friend, far be it. You know, I was there to do a job, and sometimes it's difficult when you're at a similar age, you know, because you've got the same sort of ideas and philosophies and crack, etc. But you need to be professional and be a member of staff.
Keep that distance.
And Eddie was great for me on that. And, you know, sometimes he'd pull me in and go, you know, you need to put your arm around so-and-so's shoulder because he's going through a bad time. Or you need to push so-and-so because he's dodging a bullet here and we need to get him back, or, you know, you need to get him fit. And he was great because he knew a lot of those players coming through the academy for me who I didn't know. I remember, like, H, you know, there was a situation going on with H where Eddie would give me some advice about how to help Harry. And it was fantastic advice. And having people like that in the club and mentors like that in the club are, like, you know, worth their weight in gold. So he's another great, great human being.
Speaking of Eddie and the academy, what's it been like for you watching Archie playing? Obviously, it's probably a unique thing as well. We had Rob Price on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about how it's unique when sort of monitoring a 17-year-old at the level that he's now playing. But what's it like for you as someone who's been on the inside of it, knows Eddie, knows Leeds United, watching him come through the ranks?
Yeah, incredible, right? Absolutely incredible. To have your blood and being able to see where they progress and what they do is, you know, sort of the ultimate dream. Because the other thing about becoming a professional footballer, it's such a small percentage that actually make it. And there's many, many players, right, in scenarios that, from injury, for instance, that just never quite make it. I remember a lad, Wesley Boyle, Mike, who had all the talent under the world and had the most horrendous Achilles and had surgery and just couldn't get back to the level that he was at before following his surgery.
Yeah, back-to-back injuries. It was a thing that was just ongoing niggles. The thing, the thing, again, Dave talked about before with players, Dave having a team. Like, I was lucky that I had Dave as a physio to get us through, but he's right about the surgery that I went through, and he's right about, you know, the developmentally. I also had the luxury at the time of having an extended contract. I still had 3 years to run, so I knew I had a time frame. Some of the lads that he's talking about, Wesley Boyle, didn't have that luxury. They had a one-year contract. And if you can't get yourself back after that, you're not going to renew and get a renewed contract to give you another year. So when you go out of a professional environment that is a Premier League setup, like what Dave was there with all the medical team, and then Wes found himself in the wilderness, and it's very hard to find that standard and level. And I think that's why Wes did go off the boil, because of obviously not having the luxury of that long-term contract, and he found himself in the wilderness, sadly, because he was absolutely ridiculous footballer. And I was thinking, how are you not making first team appearances like every week? That showed the standard of quality that we had as a team and a squad, but knowing that there was these absolute legends coming through, like proper ballers.
You've taken us through your time at Leeds, although I feel like we've barely scratched the surface. And we mentioned your little brief stint at that grotty West London club. But now you mentioned that you are in the United States now, and you've worked with the Knicks, the New York Knicks basketball team, and you mentioned the Nationals, the Washington Nationals baseball team. I'm a big baseball fan myself. A, how did that come about? And B, just how different is American sport but also specifically the requirements for basketball and baseball when compared to football?
Yeah, so I was at Chelsea and I basically, someone had called me and asked if I'd be interested to come in stateside. And I was just like, you know, that opportunity, I'd be quite interested in just to experience something different.
How much was the transfer fee?
I actually paid for my own plane on that one. So I basically, I went there for a year at the Knicks just as the sort of physio. And then I got promoted to be performance director. So I was overseeing everything, strength and conditioning, nutrition, psychology, medical, training, like the whole nine yards.
Wow.
And it was a real eye-opener because I didn't really know a lot about basketball, but I knew a lot about injury and rehabilitation. And then obviously, you know, if you analyze and watch enough sport, you can see how the movements occur, you know, what the injuries are, you know, and you know, take your toolbox to apply that to that athlete who needs it.
Very different injuries to football, Dave?
Not really. I mean, you know, there's ankles, knees, hip, lower back, a couple of shoulders, maybe more shoulders, but no, not really. The difference is that these guys are nearly 7 foot and, you know, weigh 130 kilos or 140 kilos. So, you know, they're big units. And the other difference is that they play every other day. And that there's a lot more traveling. So, you know, sometimes you'll play today, for instance, and then you'll be on a back-to-back and play tomorrow. And tonight we would play, for instance, tonight, we get on a plane, we land at 3 a.m. at another city in the States. And then basically you're playing that night in another city.
Yeah, the recovery turnaround's scary there.
Really scary, yeah. So, and then baseball is even worse because baseball, they play every day, sometimes twice a day.
Yeah, it's like 200 games a season. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, so I actually laugh a little bit when I hear all these people, like managers, you know, like Jurgen Klopp going on about, well, you know, it's too many games and the fixture list and it's all, you know, Christmas is crazy and this, that. And I'm like, you want to come and see what these boys do in Major League Baseball?
Yeah,
the NBA.
Come on, Dave, though. They're not running 15Ks in a game when they're swinging a club three times in every game, are we?
Yeah, but basketball is quite a physical game, you know.
Yeah, baseball, yeah. But no, basketball, I mean, they're playing for an hour and it's like five-a-side football. I mean, you're constantly moving, you're back and forth. And like you say, playing every other day must be utterly, utterly draining.
The beauty of like the opportunity for me to come to the States and do that, you know, I was there for 7 years. And then while I was there, I got asked to work for the England national team, which was obviously an honour. So I went to the World Cup in South Africa and the Euros in 2012. And then I also got asked to be on the Nike Performance Board for 5 years. So the doors that opened up for coming to the stateside, and I was really like the first English guy to be able to come over and be a performance director in the States. So that again, as an opportunity, I was just like, I can't really turn this down. And it's the best thing probably I've ever done, if I'm honest with you.
I want to talk to you more about the US thing, but I just want to put it really briefly on hold, because you mentioned you worked in the England setup there, particularly around that era that you're talking about. I just think of the immense amount of media scrutiny on, are they going to play? Are they going to be fit? You know, I feel like every year we have some kind of high profile, will he, won't he, before every major tournament. Did you feel so much of that spotlight on you? Like, is Wayne Rooney going to play, or whoever it is? Like, everyone's looking at you.
Not really. I mean, if you start thinking about or you start reading stuff in the media, then, you know, you lose focus. My view is that you do what you feel you need to do to dot the I's and cross the T's. And if the guy's fit, the guy's fit. If he's not fit, you just keep on doing your job. And at the end of the day, right, you could be the best doctor, physio, osteopath, chiropractor, nutritionist, psychologist in the world, but Mother Nature, everyone needs it. And therefore, you know, there's only so much you can do against time. So you're not miracle workers. That, you know, healing's healing.
Right.
And if you don't respect healing, it will come back and bite you in the face. And that's happened to me a lot over the years as well. And you learn a lot of lessons from your experiences of someone breaking down, for instance, and not trying to push and push and push. And it comes back in your face because you think you're nearly there. And then all of a sudden you haven't given it enough time to recover or heal.
Was there more pressure on maybe trying to get one of those star players on the plane? Or was it just the same as any other day at Leeds United, Chelsea, wherever you've been before, and it was just do it by the numbers.
So most of the decisions, obviously, with things like that would be a team approach, but it would be passed on to the doctor, and the doctor then would talk to the management. I at the national level, I wasn't in anything to do with the communication with the manager. I was just there, there just to do my job as a physio for the team and help keep people fit. It's slightly different in international because you're only with them for a week or 2 weeks. Or when you go into competition like the World Cup or the Euros, you have a lot more, but you're still only with them for, you know, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks, depending on how far the team goes. It's not like the day-to-day of working with the players and getting to know the players and communicating with the players. It's completely different. And, you know, if someone goes for international and that they're not able to play for their club, you know, very rarely are you going to be saying, well, we can take him and get him fit and play for your country, when last week they couldn't play for the club. But that decision was all left to management and left to the doctor. But again, like, great experiences of working with, you know, David Beckham, not only the Chelsea players, but and even coming back to some of the old Leeds players on international, like, you know, Rio and some of the Alan Smith, like some of the guys that probably can't even talk about on this podcast. But it was nice for me because I knew these guys who'd obviously got to the pinnacle of their careers and played for the country, and then, you know, reuniting with them again. So that, you know, was a great experience for me, and very proud to be able to do that for your country.
I was going to say the toughest thing that I found, Dave, when we went away with the 23s or the 21s at the time with England, was that the physio would change within, like, the get-together. We never seemed to have the same physio at the thing. So you're always wondering, like, who's going to be treating me? What's going to be going on? Obviously, you were there for the whole tournament, which is good for the psyche, and knew the lads going into a tournament. It was a bit different when I used to get there and thinking, oh, who's here this week, you know? So I could never really remember some of the names of the physios from a get together, which was really sad, because obviously the bond that we had with yourself, I knew Derek Wright really well from Newcastle. Everybody that you have, Neil Dalton from Carlisle, you always had a relationship. Whether you were injured or not at that football club, you're still, you know, everybody was part of the DNA. But when I got together with the national team, I'm like, well, who the hell's it going to be? So that was a very strange one for me.
That's changed now, Bridgie. I think Steve Kemp's done a really good job at the national team.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, as I said earlier, used to be at Leeds United when I was there. They now have full-time staff. So that physio or that doctor travels with that team. So there's familiarity with all the medical personnel for each of the levels, whether it's the women's teams or the men's teams. They, you know, it's a lot more professional now, whereas in the old days, it used to be someone who'd be working for another club. These are all full-time personnel now, which is much better for the players.
If you'll humour me a little bit longer, I did just want to ask you a bit more about the United States. The Nationals, obviously baseball, quite a switch, I would expect, you know, working from knees, ankles and whatnot to elbows, shoulders, backs. Was that something that you had to acclimatise to, or were you already fully versed in that as well?
I didn't really. I was more of a consultant for the Nationals, and I actually helped Harvey Sharman, who's my assistant at Leeds, get that job. And he's done an incredible job at the Nationals. In fact, they have some of the best injury records in Major League Baseball, and that's down to Harvey and the people that he has at the Nationals, for sure. And he's looked at it probably from a very different approach to what sort of traditional athletic trainers do within Major League Baseball. So I was more of a consultant for the team to sort of give them ideas about how they could improve what they do and how they do it, rather than actually putting my hands on the players. But that's, as I said, Harvey's done. He's been there now, I think, for 5 or 6 seasons. He's been there now. And from what I hear from some of the players, I treated one of the players who left that team, Bryce Harper, who now plays for the Phillies. He was like, couldn't speak highly enough of Harvey and what he's done at the Nationals. So I wasn't really putting my hands on players. But you're right. I mean, a lot of those injuries, a lot more shoulders, obliques, wrists, elbows, a lot of Tommy John issues, a lot of neurological, cervical spine, lumbar spine issues.
It feels like much more a bit like a lot of American sports. It's very specific. Like your role within a team doesn't change very much. You have very specific kind of needs that you're required. Whereas in football, you can be asked to play maybe different positions, or you just in the course of the game, you move around the field. Whereas within American sports, it seems to be quite specialized, isn't it?
Very. So I currently have got a couple of NFL players that I sort of see that I've been seeing for years. One of them plays for the Giants that I sort of see privately in the evenings. And it's very specific with what they actually do. Like American football is a bit more like playing chess, right? They're going to make this play. You've got to go from here to there. And, you know, we need you to gain the yardage. And this is how we're going to do it. And therefore, their position and what they do just doesn't change. It's like very, very regimented. And so therefore, for them, they need to be able to do X, Y, and Z to fulfill their position on the park. Whereas the other player that I look after is a wide receiver, and which is completely different from the running back, who's the other lad that I see. Completely different positions and completely different needs. So you're right, it's very, very specific. But very interesting for a Brit, you know, to be talk to them about how they prepare and what they do and how they train and how put the training around and the rehabilitation around what they're actually going to do in a game.
Yeah, I used to know a bloke who, a friend of mine called Giles, who worked for England Cricket, and he went and did a bit of a stint at the Arizona Diamondbacks. And he told me the story about how they tried to, and I'll text him after this to make sure I'm allowed to say this, but they did this kind of algorithm where they took everyone's attributes, whether it be their height, weight, et cetera, or their 100-meter speed, all this kind of stuff, and they put it into a machine, and it would spit out their optimum position, whether it was first base or, you know, outfield, whatever. And he found that what would happen was, as much as the computer would think it was their best position, these lads have played these positions since they were like 4 years old and have never moved. And so, yes, physically they might be better suited to left field, but psychologically they only know how to play shortstop. Mm. And they found it very, very difficult to switch. And I just found that really interesting, because in cricket, he said it was much, much easier. Players were much more flexible.
Are you saying that the computer's wrong, yeah?
That was the suggestion, that in this situation, these lads had played it for so long that they couldn't do it. So we need to throw all of these algorithms out the window.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, you're on the American side of it, right? I've got to say, we were on the WhatsApp group with the Leeds lads, and obviously Dave's in that WhatsApp group. It was so funny. We're asking, I think it was during COVID or before, whatever. Somebody said, oh, what's Dave Hancock up to? You know, where's he got? And somebody said, oh, well, have a look at his LinkedIn profile picture. So sure enough, we dive on there and have a look. And this is your time to shine, Dave. You can name drop whatever you want, right? As many names as you can would be brilliant. But I remember just seeing this 7 foot plus players standing with a Barack Obama in the middle. And then there was just this little lad that looked like Tyrone Dobbs off EastEnders stood next to him.
Anyway. Woody's going to love you for saying that.
Little Tyrone Dobbs. I'm thinking, what the hell? So Dave was stood next to Barack Obama on his LinkedIn profile with the Knicks. So talk us through that. And obviously I've got one more story for you that you can show on what you're doing now.
So the year before, the Knicks played the Wizards in Washington, and they had a private tour of the White House. And they were talking about it because the game was leading up to playing the Wizards again. And we had a player called Chris Doohan, who was a point guard, who went to Duke. And he played with Barack Obama's right-hand man, a guy called Reggie Love. And he'd been up to Camp David and played basketball with Barack, because Barack was a basketball nut. Right. So because of his buddy, and that it was a teammate of his, and Chris was obviously quite a smart guy. And I was treating Chris, and I said to him, what's the chances of getting the Brits? And I brought another physio over from, he was at Manchester City. I brought him over after my second or third year at the Knicks to come and work with me, called Andy Barr, who's gone on to work with the Brooklyn Nets and a boatload of other teams. And in fact, he's actually doing some work, I think, now back at Chelsea. And I said to Chris, I said, what's the chance of getting the Brits to have a look around the White House, just have a tour? And he said, would you like to go? I said, yeah, I'd love to go, right? And then me being the cheeky chappy I am, I turned around and said, if the top man is in, do you reckon we could say hello? Just throwing it out there. And he went, leave it with me. So that was it. That was the conversation. So anyway, a week before the game, he said, have you got your passport? I said, yeah, sure. So we took our passports. And he said, I've got to get clearance. I said, all right, fine. Here's the passports. And sure enough, they'd arranged. And there, I think there was six of us to go and have this tour, right? So his buddy, Reggie, Chris didn't come with us. He'd already been. We went out of the White House, going through security, no phones, and literally had all the clearance. And we had this tour. We went in the Situation Room. We went in where they do the press conference, you know, the whole nine yards. We're like, oh, this is unbelievable. I'd been in America for maybe 3 or 4 years, and Andy had only just arrived. And I'm looking at him going, wow. And then all of a sudden, Reggie comes. He says, the boss has got 5 minutes. Come on. And I'm looking at him going, I didn't really mean it. I was just being, you know, cheeky. So he's escorted us in to the, he's got two receptionists. So we're stood outside, right? And then all of a sudden, Brett comes out and he knows one of our players, Al Harrington, was with us. And Al didn't have a suit or anything. So he had to go out and buy this jumper and, you know, he just had his tracksuit. And I'm like, you can't go to the White House in a tracksuit, Al. So then I'm talking to Al and Al says, he said, oh, Brett be all right. It'd be fine. He's cool, man. He's cool. And I'm like, you're getting the White House out. So he got some, if you see the picture, he's got like a yellow jumper and some odd shaped jeans. I don't know where he got.
He's hiding at the back, isn't
he? So he's gone on and he's gone, ah, the Knicks. He's gone, the Knicks. And I've gone, oh my God. And then he's gone, hi, Al. Because I said to Al, I said, will Brack know who you are? And Al's gone, of course he'll know who I am. You know, I've been in the NBA for 9 years. I'm having a bit of a banter with him, right? So we went in and then we're having a bit of a joke. And then they brought in an official photographer, which is the picture. And then, so we're in the Oval Office, right? And I've stood there and we're having a bit of a joke. And then Al says to him, can I get some presidential cufflinks? And Barack goes, what on earth do you want presidential cufflinks for? Because apparently they give these cufflinks to members of state, right? When they come in, okay, as a gift. What do you want presidential cufflinks for? He said, what are you going to do with them? Sell them on eBay. And then I'm like, this guy's so cool. Right. And it was like, obviously, a real honor. This is my, this, I didn't get any presidential cufflinks. I got some presidential M&Ms.
are they peanut
M&Ms?
These
are peanut M&Ms from the White House.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that's the story.
And he's a big Leeds fan, I hear. That's we're able to make that an exclusive on the official Leeds United podcast that way. Barack Obama, big, huge Leeds fan.
Me and Dave, he's kept M&Ms. I would have scoffed them there and then. They would never have made it home to my house.
I heard, yeah, I mean, he said that he refuses to have red M&Ms. Is that right? He's such a big Leeds fan. That's what I'd heard. You took us round your room earlier on, and obviously those presidential M&Ms are not the only thing you've got in there. I mean, you've got the signed Madonna record, you've got plenty of James Bond memorabilia. Barack's not the only celebrity that you've met and worked with out there, is he?
I've been quite fortunate.
He's been fortunate. I'll let him showboat in a moment, right? Mike, I spoke to Dave. He was heading over to Australia. I was living in Australia a few years back. And he said, Bridgie, whereabouts are you? I said, I'm in Newcastle. He said, I'm coming into Sydney, mate. I said, coming to Sydney, what are you doing, Dave? He said, well, you know, I'm working now as a physio with a certain artist. I said, all right, who's that? He said, Bono. I said, Bono needs a physio. I said, bloody, what do you do, massage his fingers? He says, Bridgie, I'll do whatever he says with the amount of money he's paying me. As long as I massage that ego of his, we're getting on just fine. And you know what it is? This man, he offered tickets and everything backstage. And unfortunately, I couldn't get there. But I just thought, wow, what an incredible honour to be, you know, like going around and traveling and helping out people like that. And then obviously we've just seen his Hall of Fame and what he's doing now. So talk us through that scenario, mate, and what you're doing now when you do travel with these people.
I don't do too much of that anymore. So I basically worked with a band for U2. I did three tours, mainly working actually not with Bono, but mainly working with Larry Mullen, the drummer. And then I'm actually going back out with them. They're in Las Vegas at the minute. So I'm actually helping out on the periphery with The Edge. They're all really unbelievable guys. Like it's again, a bit like the Leeds United thing, that become a real family, and they are like incredible. all four of them are like incredible human beings, very different. And if you've ever been to a U2 show, you know what I'm talking about. So that opportunity came out very weirdly, which is another story. But they needed the physio. Larry needed a physio, specifically the drummer, because he's the one who gets really beat up. And I ended up just doing one tour and then got asked back on the next tour and then got asked back on the next tour. And sort of, I can't do this tour because I'm obviously running a software company now. So I really don't have much time, but I sort of, whatever I can do to help, I do, because they're the sort of people that I have the much admiration for and just love working with. So I'm actually going out on Saturday to Vegas to do about 3 or 4 days specifically with the Edge. So that's quite an honor. I'm actually looking forward to that. And then, like, when I left sport, I don't know, sort of these contacts and people that I met at various different times of your life, these doors just opened up. I got called to go and work on Bond with Daniel Craig on Spectre. He got injured and I ended up staying on the whole movie, which was, again, another fantastic human being.
Did you work with Simon Waterston and Tim Blakely on that?
Simon brought me in. And in fact, I was texting Simon yesterday. He's actually in Bollywood.
Oh, is he really?
What's your connection with Simon, Matt?
I don't know Simon, but Tim Blakely, who worked with Simon and with Daniel, would have been back on one of the older, but maybe Skyfall. I trained at their gym at Pinewood on a film called Me Before You years ago. And so I worked with Tim, but him and Simon worked closely together, and I would work in the same gym that Simon and Daniel used to train in.
So Simon has actually got a real state-of-the-art gym now at Pinewood. So that was an opening door for me and my business into movies. So we did other movies and other actors from that, and word of mouth sort of spread. And then a lot of these actors live here in New York. So like Daniel lives in New York, and then like Adam Driver, Oscar Isaacs, you know, there's a load of these actors that live and actresses that live in New York. So sort of through that network, I would get a call now and again to go and see X or to see Y. And then the same sort of thing happened through the music with U2, that I'd get a phone call or a manager would need someone, you know, to help out an artist or a dancer or whoever it would be. And if I couldn't do it, then I could put some of my team on, you know, tours with various different artists. So, you know, I've got a physio on tour at the minute with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Madonna we've looked after. So the sort of doors have opened in that sort of entertainment world for me. And it's been quite interesting, because at the end of the day, some of those legends are only there, like some of the best athletes I've been able to work with in the world, that they're there for
Thanks
a reason.
Thanks for that, Div.
Right? And they do the same preparation. Yeah. So they do the same preparation like Michael does with his body. You know, they watch their diet, they watch what they drink, they go to sleep early, you know, all these things that you would do. But like their application to their art is like, I mean, you know, like the U2 boys and like people like Madonna, right? If you'd seen what they do behind the scenes, I mean, they're relentless, relentless.
I mean, they couldn't be doing what they're doing at their age without it, could they? No. I mean, it's incredible, really.
Yeah, but just like the attention to detail, you know, and these are people that don't need to do it financially.
Right.
You know, they don't need to, you know, rehearse and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse to perfect something for, you know, like M's show just going out in London, I think, next week. So if you'd seen the prep and the hours that the woman works, I mean, it's like you'd be in awe that she's in her 60s. So it's really admirable to be on the inside of that, and, you know, whether it's a film or a music or the preparation and the people around them to prepare them to deliver night on night, similar sort of thing around a team in professional sport. And they're there for a reason, because one, they're talented, but they also can sustain the talent. So the best people for me are the ones that can reinvent themselves, stay at the very top of what they do for 20, 30, 40 years. And that's what these people have done. And that's to be just a small little cog in that ecosystem has been really fascinating for me.
That's incredible.
I've been quite lucky. I must admit, you know, one door open, another door open. I've been very fortunate, but I've always enjoyed what I do, passionate about what I do, and be very honest with people. And, you know, it's allowed me to continue doing, and like, for instance, doing something on Saturday.
Sometimes you were too bloody honest. It was things you said to me. I was like, that's close to the bone, that. No, really, but I respect you, man. Now, listen, Dave, I've got to say, like, just great to have a chat. We've chatted about this for the last 2 or 3 weeks, saying we'll have a get together on here on the Leeds United podcast, because behind the scenes, you know what, I think the fans will really appreciate. It's not just the players that are out there doing the work on the field. It's the people behind the scenes that are the unsung heroes for me, and for you just to give an insight into obviously what you've done at Leeds, your time at Leeds, and me not knowing a couple of the stories as well there about you obviously sacrificing your wages, when I know there's a lot of the footballers and staff that I've worked with in the past, mate, would never have come or dreamt of doing something like that, mate. So that was an eye opener for me, and I just want to thank you personally from the bottom of my heart. I've spoken about you before. You were the man that stopped me from retiring at the age of 21 or 22 with a serious injury. You put us on the straight path, mate, and I'm forever grateful. So thank you for coming on, and I'm delighted you went on to have the illustrious career that you well and truly deserve, because you've gone through the hard yakka, pal.
Thank you very much. That means a lot to me, and it's been quite enjoyable to reminisce with you on some of these antics that had gone on, and the journeys that we've sort of been on together.
It's going straight on the Leeds United app from the 99-2005. I'm putting it straight on there, mate, so the lads can have a good chuckle at me and you.
Well, it's been amazing for me to just sit here and listen to you both talking, and thank you so much for both of you being so open about it, about the stories, and then, you know, just the... you know, some of the darker sides of being on the treatment table, but then showing just how much fun you had all together as well. I mean, it's been really, really enlightening. So I appreciate you coming on, Dave, so much. That's been absolutely amazing.
Pleasure, Matt. And let's hope that the Mighty Whites get back on the Premiership next season where they deserve to be.
Thank you very much, sir.
And on that note, Dave Hancock, MOT, take care, my friend, as he does the monumental salute. Good man.
Well, Bridgie, thank you so much for getting Dave. That was brilliant. You know, for an international break, to get a guest of that caliber on the show to talk about those stories, the history, and then all the amazing stuff he's done since and he's doing now. I mean, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for that, Bridgie.
No, absolute pleasure. That, like I say, I hate international breaks. Thankfully, we got 6 points before the international break, so we've all gone at this in a positive, and then we're thinking, what player can we get? And like I say, when I was chatting to Dave Hancock and you guys were happy to get him on, I just think he's been a huge part of my career and a lot of other people's careers, and some of the stories I didn't know. Thoroughly enjoyed taking a trip down memory lane. So hopefully the Leeds fans enjoy that just as much and listen to Dave's story. So thank you very much. Loved it. And get rid of the international break and let's get back to getting more points and getting up this championship and getting out this division, like Dave Hancock said.
Absolutely. All for that. Well, we'll catch you next week, guys.
Take care.
See ya.